Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Herrmann, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in association with both the Arts Forum and the LGBT Forum, and also in association with Humanities West. So tonight we're going to be speaking about Romaine Brooks, the other Amazon, a great artist from the 1920s, early part of the century. And we have Karen Meese, a distinguished art historian, here to speak to us about that. And without further ado, Karen.
It's interesting because one of the major themes about the American expatriates in Paris will have to do with modernism, new movements, radical new movements in art that were taking place in Paris in the first, say, 20 years of the century. Romaine Brooks actually had absolutely nothing to do with any of that. In fact, she acted as if it weren't even going on. So she's an interesting artist, but not because she was a modernist. She actually had one foot in the 19th century, you might say, if you were being critical. People who admire her work usually compare her to the symbolist artists of the last part of one century and the first part of the next. What's been very interesting about her recently is the fact that although she was sort of ignored as an artist for many years because she didn't embrace the new isms that were, sort of falling down all over people in Paris. But feminists got interested in her. One reason is because she was a lesbian. For 50 years, she lived a non-monogamous life with a literary person, also an expatriate, Natalie Barney. So Natalie Barney and Romaine Brooks were a lesbian couple living in Paris, which of course was a good place for lesbian couples to live, because ever since 1800, 1804, when Napoleon in the Napoleonic Code made it clear that homosexuality was in no way a crime and could not be prosecuted. And that wasn't true of a lot of other places. Well, take the place across the pond in England. We all know what happened to Oscar Wilde. So in any event, I'd like to talk a little bit about her life, which she wrote about in an unpublished memoir called No Pleasant Memories. That gives you an idea. She had an absolutely horrific childhood. Her mother was mentally unstable. She had a brother who was schizophrenic and actually dangerous. Fortunately, he died shortly after his 16th birthday. But at any rate, she had a horrible childhood and seems to have spent the rest of her life somehow, sort of making up for it, being a strong woman, creating images of strong women. And that's pretty much what I would like to talk about this evening. In 1912, which is 100 years ago, right, Romaine Brooks painted herself at the edge of the Atlantic Ocean in France, where she and the poet, later patriot, Gabriella D'Annunzio, were sharing a villa. He had recently fled Italy. He had fled Italy and his debts and a whole handful of outraged suitors. And we see her here in solitude before an unfriendly-looking sea. She looks resolute. She looks even perhaps a bit defiant. And she's painted in the gray and white palette that is by now, in 1912, very established in her work. D'Annunzio, by the way, responded to this painting with a sonnet. He likened Romaine's hair, crowned by the wind of immortal courage, to her prophetic imagination. They were very much an item. They were having a rather passionate but brief love affair. The couple's romantic idyll was interrupted by the appearance or the arrival of a certain Madame Godeloff, who, according to contemporaries, never went anywhere without a gun. Okay, who is this woman? This is Beatrice Romaine Goddard, her name when she was born. She was born in 1874 in Rome, Italy, simply because her mother happened to be there. Her father, Major Godard, had left her mother shortly after Romaine's birth. He was an alcoholic. Nobody really knows whatever happened to him. But he had tons of money, as did Mrs. Goddard's family. The lifestyle was this. Mrs. Goddard would travel around staying in first-class hotels in this capital and that capital, dragging behind her her older daughter, Maya, their younger daughter, Beatrice, and the son, whose name was Henry St. Maur. That could have been part of the problem. And the mother was very much obsessed with placating and coddling this mentally unstable, crazy child. And at one point, she left Romaine with a washerwoman in a slum in New York City when she was 6 years old and disappeared. Now, the washerwoman had other children to take care of, and they very nearly starved until Romaine was sort of in a Dickensian sort of a way rescued by a wealthy relative from Philadelphia. Then came Episcopal boarding school, a convent in Italy for some years, and Mademoiselle Tavon's finishing school for young ladies in Geneva. Well, Romaine escaped finishing school and went to Paris in 1903, and she had a bare subsistence allowance from her mother. She studied painting. She sang briefly in a cabaret. She also took up bicycling, embracing athleticism and shortening her skirts and becoming, you know, a modern woman. She left Paris in 1896 for Rome, returned in 1899 after spending what turns out to be a very important summer on the island of Capri. Now, Capri was not then what it is now, but it had already been discovered by German tourists. Tolerance for homosexuals, by the way, was known there as it was unknown in Bismarck's Germany. So there were, she met all kinds of people. She met Somerset Maugham. She met friends of his. She met Charles Freer. She even met a young man whom she would later marry several years later. A homosexual gentleman who was mostly unemployed, but he was a pianist and a translator. I'm just trying to give you a little bit of her childhood, and that's what she writes about mostly in No Pleasant Memories, is her childhood. This is a family photograph from 1875. Now, her sister is not there, but this is the major who soon disappears out of this family. This is her mother, Ella Waterman, maiden name. This is Henry St. Maur. And this is Romaine as an infant. Her name was Beatrice Romaine. The middle name was because she had been born in Rome. And when she died, found in her effects were the manuscript for No Pleasant Memories, which was accompanied by this little drawing, which she writes on the bottom, St. Maur, her brother, stood between me and the whip. That's her mother. And she confesses that sometimes St. Mar would actually interfere in her mother's sort of fierce denunciations of everything that Romaine was trying to do. Now, this is a self-portrait drawing done in about 1900. And I think you can see here already in this charcoal drawing that she has an ability to capture not only physiognomy, but posture and costume. And that is going to do her well because she is going to decide on portraitures as a profession. Well, her mother died in 1902, just a year after the death of St. Mar. I guess she couldn't live without him. And Romaine became a very, very wealthy young woman. She moved to London and lived in fashionable circles. In fact, she lived in a house on Tite Street, where Whistler's White House still stood. It's still standing today. And just across the street from John Singer Sargent. That she was influenced by Whistler, of course, is immediately apparent when we look at her works. But although she embraced his palette, not only in her paintings, but in her surroundings, in the decor of her house and studio, she did not share his love for abstraction. We'll see there's a difference there. Then in 1903, she married that old friend, we could call him that, from Capri, John Ellington Brooks, and she took his name. So she becomes Romaine Brooks. And it was a marriage of convenience? Probably. He was a homosexual, and although the marriage lasted only a year, she continued to support him. She could well afford to support this young man. She moved briefly to St. Ives on the Cornish coast. There was a very well-established artist colony in St. Ives. And this is where she painted images of unidentified women. By the way, I'm showing you here a painting by James Whistler of Charles Freer. Many scholars think that Charles Freer, whom she had met on Capri, would have been able in London to take her around Whistler's digs and take her around to places where Whistler's art was being displayed. Whistler, of course, died in 1902, so there wouldn't have been any direct, you know, relationship between them. This is a painting from St. Ives, the charwoman. We don't know who she is. She's there against this monochromatic background. While she was at St. Ives, she painted women, not important women, but women in sort of Whistlerian tones. Then, in 1908, she comes back to Paris. And when she comes back to Paris, she is able, now a woman of great wealth, to live in the 16th arrondissement in a beautiful home. She's studying art at the Academy Colarossi, which next to the Academy Julien was the finest academy to be studying at the time. And she was busy preparing for her one-person show at the Galleries Durand-Ruel. And in 1910, the exhibit opened. Now, this is important because this is a very, very prestigious gallery. Durand-Ruel, discovered certain artists like Renoir, Cézanne. He had one-person shows for Bert Morisot, for any number of the Impressionist and Post-Impressionist artists. And in 1910, this exhibit, this one-person exhibit for Romaine Brooks opened. And before it opened, she managed, in preparation, she redecorated Durand Ruel's gallery. I mean, I guess he just sort of stood back and said, well, all right. And she covered the red plush satin walls with plain beige fabric that set off her palette of gray, umber, taupe, etc., with only the occasional splash of red or white, which we'll see. Her works, and now I'm going, we are now imagining ourselves transported to Paris, why not? And we're in the Durand Ruel Gallery, and these are the paintings that she exhibited. There were 13 paintings. This is simply entitled A Woman with a Black Cap. We don't know who she is. She's against this sort of ochre background, wearing simply black and white. And this is Madame, we know who this woman is. She was rather a famous designer and decorator in Paris at the time. And she actually commissioned the artist to paint her portrait. She looks like she sort of decorated herself. I mean, she's very, very much, very, very stylishly decorated. You could do a whole essay on the kind of hats women wore from about 1908 to 1912. But notice the background white. So it's simply a black and white image with these little tiny bits of ochre. This is called The Veil. Now, we don't know who this woman is either. This was immediately purchased by a collector of symbolist paintings. And in fact, I can tell you that most of her paintings, she did not have a large output, perhaps 35 or 40 paintings in her entire life. And many of them, most of them, are in the Smithsonian, the American portion of the Smithsonian Museum today. She left them to the Smithsonian, which was then called the National Museum of Fine Art. But on the wall here in her studio is one of her framed paintings that she did while she was at St. Ives. And they appear frequently in the background of her paintings, which is a very Whistlerian sort of thing to do. If you're familiar with Whistler's portraits, you know that he very often put works of art on the wall in back of his sitter. This is a lovely little, probably still young girl, a teenager. It's called Green Bows. And here she is, of course, against a very, you know, very monochromatic. And she very often does this sort of thing where, you know, the green bows are that very pale green that actually you see Whistler using as well. And then you have a balcony and the city in back of her. Show you a few more. This is simply called The Debutante. And then it was when it was, bad throat here, excuse me. That should be water, but it isn't. Anyway, La Debutante, the pink dress, 1910. No one can figure out why, for heaven's sakes, this turkey is here. perhaps some sort of, you know, it must have been something that was important to this young girl in her coming out dress, but it's never been resolved. But this, too, because of this some sort of symbolic feeling about it, was collected by Mr. Awi. Thank you so much. That's sweet of you. It has that symbolist quality. There's something going on here that we don't quite understand that makes it very mysterious. And this one is another one in the Lucille Awi collection in Paris today. Her husband died, left her his paintings, and she is now the person from whom two different curators had to borrow paintings for exhibits. Adeline Breeslin borrowed a whole lot of paintings from Lucille Audouy in 1971 when she did an exhibit at the Smithsonian. And Whitney Chadwick also borrowed paintings when she did an exhibit at the National Museum of Women in the Arts in the year 2000. So we all owe this woman, or her husband, really, a debt. What's this all about? The white bird, a white bird in a cage, some flowers here reflected in the mirror. It's all very mysterious. We're not told who the person is. So you can see why this sort of painting appealed to people who had admired the symbolist painters of the turn of the century. This is called The Piano. This gentleman in Paris has still not written back to give me permission to use this image, so I hope none of you are related to him. Anyway, The Piano, 1910, figure in profile, gray against darker gray. Again, you know, very much the influence of Whistler. But there's something, you know, one thing that she complained about Whistler, is that his portraits really didn't reveal anything about the subject. There was no sort of psychological penetration in Whistler's portraits. And I think she was right about that. Just speaking of Whistler, is probably, maybe, perhaps an inspiration to Brooks. This is his very famous painting, At the Piano, painted probably in 1859. And then later, 10 years later, Brooks would paint one of her best friends, whom she had met at Capri and remained friends with all her life, the pianist Renata Borgatti. So here's Renata Borgatti at the piano in 1920. What she's done, of course, is to eliminate color, eliminate the little girl, eliminate just about everything here, except the artist at work, a female artist at work, a very strong-looking, masterful artist at work. Also included in this exhibit at the Durand-Ruel Gallery were two nudes. Now, this one appears to be a model. We don't know who she was. A very slender, almost androgynous-looking model, clad only in a red jacket, standing before a screen in Romaine Brooks's studio. When asked about this and what it meant, she said she was cold. Anyway. And this, of course, was the hit of the show. She calls it White Azaleas. And this is done in her studio. Her studio was decorated with sort of off-gray walls, and a lot of the small paintings that she had done at St. Ives framed in black. And she liked to have huge masses of white azaleas in black lacquer containers. So the whole color scheme was black and white and gray. We don't know who the model is, but it was much remarked upon. Someone called, someone of course had to compare it naturally to Goya's nude Maja of 1800. The posture is very similar. And then someone, of course, because this was France, had to compare it to Manet's Olympia, the prostitute here, painted by Manet and exhibited in 1865. Well, the difference is here that both of these paintings were painted by men. And White Azaleas was painted by a woman. And the type of figure is very much different. She's small-breasted, long of limb, ever so slightly, you know, androgynous looking, almost like a young boy. But at any rate, she exudes sex, but not the same kind of sex exuded by Manet's Olympia. Now, this is a portrait by a gentleman who was well known as a dandy, as an art critic. His name, the Comte Robert de Montesquieu. And he is actually he's a real person painted here by Giovanni Boldoni. And Montesquieu was the model, actually, for Joris Huysmans' Des Essientes, and later by Charlus by Proust, in Remembrance of Things Past. He was a dandy. He was sort of famous for being a man of great interest in art and not much else, that sort of thing. But he declared at the end of the exhibit, when the exhibit was closing at the galleries in 1910, that Romaine Brooks was a thief of souls, because she was able to, he wrote this article in Le Figaro, and he commented on her ability to capture the essence of her, the psychological essence of her sitters. This is Romaine Brooks, then, now labeled Thief of Souls, and that's what Adeline Breeson called her exhibit in 1971 at the Smithsonian, was Romaine Brooks, Thief of Souls. There she is in 1910. You can see she's bobbed her hair and taken on masculine attire, at least some of the time. And this is her studio. And, of course, you know, this is evidence now of the fact that this is her studio. There's the white azaleas. These are the paintings that I have just showed you. By the way, the photographs that we have available to us today are from her nephew. Her sister Maya, about whom she writes absolutely nothing in her memoirs, married, had two children, then one of those children had a son, and he's the one who has the huge collection of family photographs. They didn't get along. Her sister was very conventional. She didn't approve of Romaine's unorthodox love affairs. The only thing they had in common is they both hated their mother, basically. Now, going on a little bit here, she painted, she specialized in portraits. And as someone pointed out, her sitters were either titled, famous, elegantly scandalous, intellectually elite, or a combination of the above. And that's pretty much true. Of course, Truman Capote was quoted later on after the 1971 exhibit as saying it was the biggest all-time gallery of famous dykes in the world. But that's Truman Capote, and that's in 1971. I want to just show you now some of these portraits, because portraits is what she does. Here's Jean Cocteau. She wanted to paint from her studio. This was massed with all these white azaleas and black lacquer tables and black and white striped rugs and gray walls. She wanted a picture of the Eiffel Tower. And so she had her friend Jean Cocteau pose for her and painted him with La Tour Eiffel in the background. And she calls it At the Time of the Ferris Wheel, because it was at this time that the Ferris Wheel first appeared in a Paris exhibition, first having, I think, debuted in 1893 in Chicago. I think that's right. Anyway, now, I mentioned before that when she did that self-portrait of herself at the edge of the sea in 1912, that it had been highly praised by Gabriel D'Annunzio. And at the same time that she did her portrait, this is still in the same place where they're sharing this villa, she paints this portrait, which she calls Gabriella D'Annunzio, Poet in Exile, dated 1912. Well, he was in exile, and I explained sort of why. But, you know, he was, apparently he was, in spite of the fact of being short, pockmarked, had very little hair, was sort of pudgy, women were very much attracted to him. So at one time, he had several suitors in Italy, and at one time, Romaine Brooks and Gabriel D'Annunzio and Ida Rubinstein, the Russian Jewish dancer from Russia, were having a sort of triangular affair. So things get very complicated here. This is another portrait that the image is only available in black and white. And this hangs in Gardone in Italy at Il Vittoriale, which is a building dedicated to the great patriot, quote unquote, Il Comandante D'Annunzio, painted by Brooks in 1916 with a huge airplane in the background. This is a photo of D'Annunzio, who became Mussolini's military hero, mostly because of the fact that after the First World War, he was very upset that in the treaties, Fiume, which is called Rijeka today, Fiume was ceded to what was then Yugoslavia rather than to Italy. So he simply marched over there with an army and occupied Rijeka Fiume for 15 months. This endeared him tremendously to Mussolini. And so then a very, very close tie develops between Mussolini and D'Annunzio. Here is the portrait, just to remind you that these were painted as pendants, as companion pieces. Her portrait of Gabriella, who she called Gabri, and her own self-portrait. Now, enter, at this time, Ida Rubinstein. Ida Rubinstein was from Russia. She had joined the Ballet Russe, and she had already appeared in Paris in Cleopatra and in a couple of other ballets. Now, what happens here is that Gabriel D'Annunzio writes a new ballet for Ida. He writes the book. Debussy writes the music. Serge Diaghilev is the general director. It is staged in Paris. Now, this is a painting. The whereabouts of this painting, unknown, and we only have this black and white image. But Brooks painted this, and she called it The Masked Archer, and we believe that this is supposed to be Gabriel D'Annunzio pointing arrows at Ida Rubinstein. Why? Because the ballet he had written was called The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. And she played Saint Sebastian. You know, she wasn't a very good dancer. She was too tall, for one thing. But she was very dramatic, and she got lots of good roles. Here is Romaine Brooks's photograph of Ida Rubinstein, dating to about 1911, 1912. And you can see that we're in Brooks's studio with the white azaleas and that sofa and all of that. So Rubenstein really had a very close relationship to Brooks. She really wanted them to go off together and buy a villa in the country. Romain Brooks was not interested in doing that, but they were close. And pretty soon, Gabriel D'Annunzio was a little bit out of the picture, and it was just Brooks and Rubenstein. This is a sketch of Ida done in 1912, an oil sketch where she surrounds her with this aura, this sort of mandala of light. And just to show you what she looked like, according to some other artist, here is Antonio de la Gandara, his famous painting of Rubenstein in 1912. She was, of course, extremely attractive, as you can see in this image. And here's a little more information now on the martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. Ballet Russe, Diaghilev, of course, the score by Debussy, the dramatist D'Annunzio, the venue, Paris, 1911. And this is a costume design by Leon Bakst, who did lots of costume designs for the Ballet Russe. And here is Saint Sebastian before really bad things start happening to him. And here, on the other hand, what are we going to do for a costume for this? So we just sort of wrap her in a lot of gold threads, and we've got the arrows. Anyway, it was a smashing success. She did another painting of Ida Rubenstein called The Crossing, done in 1911, that is totally monochromatic. It's simply black, gray, and white. And here is a portrait done in 1917. She talks about walking out in the Bois de Boulogne with Ida, and she was dressed in a certain way, and she always had this strange headpiece that would have looked weird on anybody else, but she carried it off. This is another painting of Ida, Spring, 1912. This of course, was immediately purchased by the great lover of symbolist paintings. I think it has a lot to do with artists like Maurice Denis, painting here April in 1892, the winding path, the costumed women. And this one, which was actually in the Audouin collection before they purchased Spring by Romain Brooks. The artist is Louis Hawkins, Procession of Souls. Those paintings were very popular with certain collectors. One more time, the Weeping Venus, painted in 1916-1917. So that's the last portrait we have of Ida Rubenstein. I just wanted to mention that she painted one other woman nude, and that was the Marchesa Luisa Casati in 1920. When the Marchesa Luisa Casati died, there were 178 portraits of her in her estate. Tells you something about her. Giovanni Boldoni painted La Casati at least three times. Here she is with greyhounds. Man Ray did this wonderful double image photograph. It was her eyes that people were fascinated with. She was the muse to the Italian futurists. And in the following image, Marinetti, the leader of the futurist movement, is writing a dedication to La Marchesa Casati. It's a painting by Carlo Carrà. And in the little dedication, he mentions her eyes like a jaguar's lying in the sun. Well, she had huge green eyes, and they were heavily lined with coal, or black, whatever you call it, and enhanced with drops of belladonna. She was really something to look at. There is the portrait of Marinetti with the dedication. And it's interesting to look at this and realize, you know, this is what was going on when Romaine Brooks was painting. Cubism, fauvism, futurism, you know, all of this stuff. And she was just blithely doing her own thing. When she was in England with Ida Rubinstein when war was declared, and she painted this patriotic image of France, a personification of France, for which she won the ribbon of the Legion of Honor. And it was exhibited in 1915 with a poem handwritten by D'Annunzio. You can see the city of Ypres there, a little better here, burning in the background. Those are Ida Rubinstein's features, but it's not a portrait of Ida Rubinstein. It is a personification of France with the cross of the Red Cross adorning her. In 1915, Romaine met Natalie Barney, and for the next 50 years, they carried on a close but non-monogamous relationship. Barney was one of the Salonistes of Paris, along with Gertrude Stein. Natalie Barney had salons every Friday evening on the Rue Jacob. This is actually a portrait of Natalie Barney by her mother, Alice Pike Barney, who was an accomplished artist herself. This is how she would have liked Natalie Barney to look. It isn't the way Natalie Barney looked. This is Natalie's two-story house, 20 Rue Jacob in Paris, where she had her weekly salons. And Juna Barnes, I mean, just about every intellectual lesbian in Paris attended her salons, as did a number of men. Ezra Pound, for instance, a lot of the intellectuals in Paris attended Natalie's salons. Ernest Hemingway, by the way, never did. He declined. That's understandable, I think. There's Natalie Clifford Barney in 1917. But, you know, by the time this relationship began, Romaine Brooks wasn't really painting that much. So Natalie Barney can't really be seen as an influence on Romaine Brooks' painting. That just doesn't work. She did paint this wonderful portrait of her friend called L'Amazone in 1920. Remy de Gourmont had christened Natalie L'Amazone. She liked to ride horses, by the way. And the horse that you see in the painting is jade, a very dark jade, and belonged to Romaine. And you can see her house there in the background. There's a blow-up of it, so you can see it a little clearly. So this is Natalie Barney L'Amazone. And I just decided that I should call Romaine Brooks the other Amazon because of their close relationship. This is called the Huntress or Boreal. It's probably a young woman who was an artist and a protege of Natalie Barney. And notice she too is an Amazon. She has one bare breast. You can see right here. And I'm going to show you another image just because it's a little clearer. There you go. Very chiseled features. All of these people are part of their circle. Elizabeth of Grandmont was a lover of Natalie Barney before Romaine happened, as it were. And this is another woman who was in this circle of women in Paris. Here's Elizabeth de Grandmont, by the way, in a photo by Nadar, the famous French photographer. And notice here, quite a few years later, Romaine decks her out with the sort of fancy male clothing, but a very elaborate male clothing. And here's the Baroness Emile d'Arlanger, another member of this intellectual elite, with her attribute, the animal next to her. She did that a lot in her paintings. Now, Una, Lady Troubridge, divorced her husband to marry Radcliffe Hall. When Romaine did her portrait, she wrote in a letter to Natalie, "Una is really funny to paint. Her getup is remarkable." So it's a caricature. It can be seen as a sort of a caricature about the way Una insisted on dressing. This is Radcliffe Hall, Una's lover, and the author of The Well of Loneliness, which you may remember was banned in the UK. There was a huge lawsuit about it. And this has got to be a caricature. Elsie DeWolf was a famous decorator. And Romaine Brooks believed that she stole her, Romaine's, ideas. You might remember that Elsie DeWolf told everyone to paint everything white. Well, actually, that turns out to... But the way she puts her in this silly little thing that looks like a shower cap and then has this little white goat next to her is, I think, borders just a little bit on cruelty. I don't know. Maybe I'm just reading that in there. This is Peter, a young English girl. That's the title of the painting. The model is Hannah Gluckstein, who was known as Gluck. She was English, and she commissioned the portrait that you see here. Most of these were all in the artist's collection when she died. Now, these are late paintings. She didn't paint much after 1935. In fact, she only did two paintings. This one of Muriel Draper that's now at Yale University. And this, and there, by the way, is a photograph, just to show you how she's really kind of got it right. This is Muriel Draper, the columnist and arbiter of taste and so forth and so on. Carl von Vechten's photograph of Muriel Draper. And then we have Romaine Brooks' portrait of Carl von Vechten done in 1936. She had met him in Paris much earlier, back in around 1910 about, through Gertrude Stein. Von Vechten was a correspondent for the New York Times at the time, and then later became, of course, a very, very famous photographer. This image is only available from Yale for some reason in black and white. And here is his photo portrait of Romaine Brooks in 1936. So they went back and forth. This is in the Smithsonian. I think I have two E's in Gertrude there. Sorry. The very last portrait she did was in 1961 of her very old friend, Duke Uberto Strozzi. And it's painted at the Strozzi Villa in Settignano, which is outside of Florence. The Duke was in his late 70s, and Brooks was 87. Well, I don't really think I have time for this, but I want you to know that she did a number of drawings that were found in the artist's effects when she died in Nice in 1970. She was estranged by that time from everyone, including Natalie Barney. Back in 1930, she'd been laid up with an injury to her knee, and she did a whole bunch of drawings that were found along with the manuscript to No Pleasant Memories. They have now become very interesting to scholars who see them having a certain Beardsleyan, I mean Aubrey Beardsley, kind of quality to them. And of course, they're very interesting to people who are simply interested in drawings, what a line can do, you know, the line. Paul Klee said art was all about taking a line for a walk. So with that, I'm going to close and ask you if you have any questions at all. Yes.
What did she do for those 35 years till her death?
very...
Yes, why did she stop painting?
No one knows. She seems to have become very embittered. And she and for a while, she and Natalie traveled a lot. There are pictures of them traveling. They're in Florence. They're here. They're there. Then about 6 years before her death, she became very reclusive. She stopped, you know, she broke off from Natalie. When she was ill, when she was dying, Natalie tried to send her doctor down. She was living in Nice with two old Italian servants. She became a hypochondriac. She had to have her food pureed, and she was afraid that this was going to happen, that was, et cetera. She became very embittered, and it's sad because I like to remember her as the young, you know, artist in London and St. Ives and, you know, that sort of thing. But she did, in fact, let me just, in answer to your question, she must have just kind of spent a lot of time collecting things, because when she died, they found, along with her manuscript and these drawings, a collection of notebooks, 60 silk scarves, 62 identical berets, 12 pairs of unworn shoes, dried up tubes of paint, a diary from 1923, a silver cigarette case from Gabriel D'Annunzio, and 150 gold coins stuffed in medicine bottles. So we don't want to think of her that way. So we think of her as the woman we saw in our first slide. Anybody
well,
else?
If I did my math right, she was 96 when she died.
She was 96
so,
when she died.
I mean, that might have come for what you did the last 10 years of your life between 86 and 96.
Yeah,
Yeah, I'd like to remind our audiences online and on the radio that they're listening to Karen Meese speak about Romaine Brooks, the other Amazon at the Commonwealth Club in California, and we have time for a few more questions. I would like to use this so that it gets on the recording of the lecture.
Oh.
I was wondering if there's any documentation that she's ever seen the work of Edvard Munch, because on some of those early paintings where you were comparing her to mm-hmm. Whistler and she didn't really look like Whistler. There was one that was a side view of a woman sitting mm-hmm. that reminded me of some of Munch's pictures of his sister sitting next to her deathbed.
Yes, I know which one.
And it had that same pathos that is not really there in the Whistler paintings.
Right. I don't know how familiar she would have been with Munch, because I don't know how much he was exhibited in Paris during the time she was there. Or whether she would have seen his work when she was in England. That's something, no one has ever suggested that, so it's really an interesting suggestion. But I don't know.
Next question.
Yeah, where would you place her sort of in the world of art? She didn't seem to belong to any of the movements of the day. She seemed kind of isolated off by herself. I'm just wondering where you would kind of place her.
Well, I would say that you're absolutely right. She certainly doesn't fit into the period, you know, in which she was working. And she sort of ignored modernism, which is kind of interesting because that makes her an anachronism in this whole expatriate thing we're studying at Humanities West. But I would say that she aligns herself most clearly with the symbolists of the earlier part of the century, yeah, and she's an anachronism. You know, one thing that's interesting is how very unconventional she and Natalie Barney were with, you know, the way they lived. They had all these women coming in, and they were sort of doing ancient Greek stuff and sapphic, you know. It was a very unconventional lifestyle. But her art is so conventional, whereas Gertrude Stein was embracing Picasso and all that, and yet lived a very staid, rather conventional life with Alice Toklas. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I have a question about, you mentioned Natalie's salon and Gertrude Stein's salon is at the same time. So there's two different groups, and you said Hemingway didn't visit Natalie's, but he certainly visited Gertrude
Stein. Oh, yes,
Stein's.
He certainly did.
So it wasn't that issue. So do you comment on that? What was the difference between the two? Were these competitive salons?
Well, I just think, I don't know.
They sort of had a semi-public kind of feud that may not have been an actual feud, but they did have really different camps that aligned themselves with them, and it's just sort of because of who they embraced and the aesthetics that they both embraced. But oftentimes, yeah, you found that people either went to Natalie's or they went to Gertrude and Alice's, and there wasn't a lot of crossover between. And there's a couple of things in Natalie's writings where she sort of snipes a little bit. Yeah, she gets a little nasty about Gertrude and Alice, and vice versa. Alice famously said that Natalie used to pick up women in the bathrooms at the department stores, you know? So, yeah. Yeah.
Paris was a woman, or Paris is a woman. It's either Paris was a woman or Paris was a woman. Interesting documentary about, you know, all of these women in Paris at the time. Juna Barnes and, you know, all the rest of them. It's interesting.
Time for two or three more questions.
Anybody else have? Isn't it likely that she could have had mental illness, considering her mother and her brother, and, you know, I mean, it might account for her behavior, certainly in later life.
I've never thought of that. Of course, you know, all of us have, you know, little areas where we're a little unstable. She may have been, unstable in certain ways. And of course, it's a natural question to ask when her mother was obviously had problems and her brother was certifiable, you know, really. But
you mentioned she had a few commissions. Did she make much money from this? I know she was a very wealthy woman. Did she earn
no money?
Yeah.
She didn't need to make any money, of course, number one. And number two, she kept, you know, she really did stop painting. I think when she and Natalie got together, that wasn't, she had sort of done her thing. And she kept exhibiting the same paintings over and over again.
I'm just curious as to, you've done so much research and provided so much for us. Is she being lost to history? And how should we try to find out more about her?
Well, I think that in 1971, there was this great exhibit at the Smithsonian. And that sort of put her, and Hilton Kramer even remarked on her, you know, and blah, 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 blah. So, but she's so out of step. But, you know, that's happened to other painters. John Singer Sargent was literally forgotten, you know, for many, many, many years because he painted in a very traditional, and he painted portraits, and he was resurrected. So maybe she can be resurrected. Or perhaps she's been resurrected about as much as she can be, because when Whitney did this exhibit in the year 2000, she said just about what you can say about her works, unless someone gets to work on these drawings, which are, you know, could be the most interesting things that she did. So I think that's, as far as art historians are concerned, that's the area for examination. Her portraits have been exhibited over and over and over again now. And the Smithsonian owns most of them, but then there are two of them in the, there are four of them in French museums, but that's it. Two in the Carnoubles and two in the Pompidou. That's it.
Yeah. The 1910 exhibit at the famous gallery.
Yeah.
Do you know whether they were interested in her as an artist, or did she pay for the use of the galleries? I mean, because she was so wealthy, I don't know, because she didn't become... Is there any information about that?
That hasn't been discussed, but I don't think that Durand Ruel would have been susceptible to bribes. He didn't need to be.
Right. I assumed that much. I just was wondering under her circumstances.
Yeah.
Time for one last question. Who would like to ask the last question?
You want to look at some more? Okay, I'll just flip them by.
Why don't we look at some more pictures? Great idea.
Footstool. Well, that they're interesting. There are hundreds of them. And, of course, in the notebook she left behind, she does make the comment that her mother stood between me and life. It sounds ungrammatical, doesn't it? But she did say that. My mother stood between me and life. And that's why Meryl Sechrist, let's go through here and I'll put these. That's the way I want to remember
Absolutely.
Her.
Absolutely.
This is the literature. There was the exhibition catalog by Adeline Breeskin, and then Whitney's catalog in 2000. That was also in 2000, earlier in the year at the Berkeley Art Museum. And then Meryl Sechrist is her biographer, and she calls her book Between Me and Life. She's quoting comment in her No Pleasant Memories.
If you believe that it's the drawings that have the most possibility of
if someone
would be responsible for bringing that forward? Who has control over those drawings?
The Smithsonian. Yeah, the Smithsonian owns the drawings. Oh, there's some few here and there, but mostly they own. Yeah. But no, if some poor art graduate student has to work on her, I would say the drawings. You know, do the drawings. Because we've said so much already about the portraits. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank
it was
you very
fun.
Much.
I had a good time.
Thanks for coming. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion.